call order of the House Committee on Healthcare and open an informational meeting on the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. And I'll ask Missy Dolan and whoever else you would like to join us, Robin Richardson, anybody else? No? Okay. You don't want to join us, Dr. Smith? Only if you want to. Well, Missy, when you get in trouble, you can call for anybody else in the room to help. No, not when, if you get in trouble.
Okay.
Go for it.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Missy Dolan. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. Thank you for inviting me here today to give you an update on the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. With me today is Robin Richardson, who represents the ODS companies. And ODS, as some of you may know, is our new partner in administering this program. And Robin is specifically very involved with negotiations with manufacturers. So briefly, I prepared this Valentine's Day handout that gives you a summary, mostly by year, in the beginning of where OPDP came from. In 2003, the passage of Senate Bill 875 established the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, thanks to Representative Greenlick and largely due to his efforts and Senator Morissette's efforts. That original statute provided for some uninsured residents and all public sector groups to come into this program. In 2004, I was hired to implement the program. In 2005, we launched in March with the program, and in 2006, several strategic changes took place. We joined with the Washington Prescription Drug Program to form the Northwest Prescription Drug Consortium to increase our purchasing powers from 1 million to 7 million. Potential members. We formed that joint solicitation and negotiation, brought our new partners, the ODS companies, along with Well Partner Mail Order, both Oregon companies. Then in 2006, voters approved ballot measure 44 that opened the enrollment to all uninsured residents. And then in 2007, Senate Bill 362 passed, opening enrollment to all underinsured and private sector groups. So the next little chart gives you a breakdown of the members by state, and today we have got. And actually, I've
by county.
By county.
Is that what?
Oh,
no, I'm sorry.
No, it's by state.
Not the back page. I'm sorry. Excuse me.
I've actually given you the actual enrollment through January and estimated enrollment through March 4th, because on March 4th, we've got a substantial group coming on. State Accident and Insurance Fund in Oregon is joining us with 18,000 to 20,000 average members per month. So I estimated the uninsured members' growth in each state based on what we have been averaging, and by March 4th, we're looking at a potential of 360,000 members. The large group that came on in Washington January 1st was their public employees that joined the program. They started their due diligence to join the program last January. They actually signed a contract in March and have been going through implementation ever since. Savings for the uninsured on this program average 42% off. That's about $24 per prescription. Members can enroll without using paper by either enrolling online or calling an 800 number. All prescriptions that are written by a licensed clinician are covered under this program. There is no cost to join. 551 pharmacies have voluntarily joined the program and participate in our network, and that includes every major chain in Oregon. The second attachment that I've shown you is a map, a geomap, that actually Representative Kotek asked for a year ago, and we gave her that a year ago, but we thought we would give an update, because it shows the enrollment of the approximately 60,000 members through January by county, and it also shows the, actually it shows the uninsured in each county, and then it shows the enrollment as well by county. So you can see, if you look at the counties you represent, how many uninsured are there and how many OPDP members are in that county. So that's it for my summary. If you have any questions, Robin and I would both be happy to answer them.
one question, clarification.
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, could you clarify, if I thought that it was for those that are uninsured, and yet you're saying that huge groups are joining, and I would assume that those groups had prescription insurance, so how does that work?
Representative Greenlake and Representative Richardson, the pool has always had two sides. On one side, it's individuals, and it's currently all uninsured or underinsured individuals. On the other side, groups come into the pool, and actually it's the group, the potential group growth that gives us negotiating leverage with pharmacies and with the ODS companies and with manufacturers. So groups are very important. Now, how they come into the pool is that they can either get their RX benefit through a carrier, or they can self-insure it and have a third party administer their benefit program for their prescription drugs, or they can come into the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, and ODS actually administers the benefit for them. They can self-insure that benefit just like they may on the outside, or they can have a fully insured product, and ODS actually underwrites that. We have an insured offering now. We've just established that in 2008 because our partner is now a carrier.
In the original 875, it included governmental groups, and then that was expanded as a result of the initiative and as a result of the last session to other groups. Other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Oh, I'm sorry. I have a list. Representative Kotek?
Oh, Representative Maher.
Representative Maher?
My question, the Washington State employees are now apart, and when did they join?
Representative Greenlake and Representative Maher, January 1st of 2008, they joined.
Paul?
Please just go right ahead.
And have there been conversations with the public employees board in the state of Oregon?
Chair Greenlake and Representative Maher, yes, there have been conversations since I was hired in 2004, actually, and we have just recently done a repricing for our public employees, and my understanding is that PEB is going to have a third party review the repricing compared to what they're currently getting.
And when do we expect a report or a decision on that?
When is their current contract run out as a piece of the question?
Yeah.
End of the year.
End of the year. And so the report will come at the end of...
Actually, we have given our version of the report to PEB.
Oh, so they're looking
so we've
for a
done
third party.
Analysis, okay. And they're waiting to have a third party do that analysis, and I'm not sure what their time frame is.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was actually my question, because I'm now ex officio on the PEB board. So,
we have a spy.
You know, I'd like to see that information on, because I'm just on the board, so that was probably a while ago. Did you make a presentation to the full board on that?
I made a presentation to the PEB board about 2 months ago.
About 2 months ago, okay.
Yeah, but the repricing was not part of that. We were actually asking for a repricing to be able to do it, and we have just finished the repricing, and that was probably about 2 or 3 weeks ago. So PEB has the information, and now it's up to them to get the analysis done.
Great. I'll follow up with them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Missy, I have a question. Same question we've covered in the past. In the early stages of this, and you've done a fantastic job. You guys have both done a great job. I mean, you're really to be commended. It's moving forward in a great way and working out the relationship with the state of Washington, I think, was a huge difference. Right now, on the individual side, most of the burden for making sure the discounts happen is falling to individual pharmacists. And we have, as you point out, a very large number. What's that number?
151.
Some very large number of individual pharmacists who are essentially offering a discount. I mean, so it turns out to be a discount card without anything coming back to the pharmacist. It's very clear for this to work, and the underlying concept was that it wouldn't be only on the back of the retail pharmacist, that we find some way to get rebates. We move market share, we get rebates from the drug companies. The rebates from the drug companies somehow come back to the pharmacist, or if not to the pharmacist, they don't have to offer the discount, comes back to the members or something. And I know we've had some conversations back during the regular session on where we are with that. And could you sort of bring us up to date? To what extent will these larger contracts, for example, help move rebates for the individual members as well? What are we going to do to make sure it's worthwhile for the pharmacist to stay in this program? Because if they give it up, then we really don't have anything.
Chair Greenick, I'm going to let Robin Richardson answer that because he has been the lead negotiator for WPDP and OPDP in our negotiations, although we're all at the table. But before I turn it over to Robin, I would like to give you two points. First of all, recently in December we had an article appeared in the Oregonian. It was huge, and it was a very good article, and it doubled our enrollment to the uninsured. Shortly after that, Jim Thompson, the executive director of the Pharmacy Association, did an informal survey of pharmacists, and he got some feedback on OPDP, and what that feedback was that the increased volume, business volume, from people coming into their stores and buying other things was actually paying off compared to the concession they were giving on the discounts, which was really positive feedback from us. Yeah. The second point I'd like to make is that I've been talking to people in other states, and very specifically Ohio. They've got a good discount program in Ohio. They have 22 contracts with manufacturers currently for rebates for their discount program. And recently they've been having a problem with their pharmacists because with all of those contracts with manufacturers, the savings that are brought to the table are representing 6% of the overall savings for their program. And the pharmacists are providing 94% of the savings. And so the pharmacists were saying, what's up with this? 6% just isn't enough. And they were very happy with their manufacturer's contracts. Now, I'm not making any kind of excuses, but I'm saying we are working on manufacturer's contracts. But that's not to say that I'm going to expect to come to you in a year and say that the manufacturers are now providing 50%, because experience around the country is showing that that's not going to happen. But, Robin,
we talked about several months ago they were providing 0%. And what percent are they providing now?
We're receiving about, I just saw a check today for $1,200, and that's in 1 month.
And up till now, that money would have, it's been relatively de minimis when it goes back to the administration of the program?
It's minuscule.
Yeah.
So, it's minuscule.
So the answer is still zero. So I'm not saying 50%, but I'm saying going from zero to zero isn't moving us much closer to 50%.
No, absolutely. I agree with you. Robin, do you want to?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Robin Richardson, Vice President of Medical Services for the ODS companies. We have been working, obviously, very closely with the manufacturers to identify manufacturers who are interested in and will come to the table based on a variety of factors, volume being one, the group's participation being another, and working with us and providing rebates for a discount card, unlike other discount cards that they don't currently provide rebates for around the country. And we are very close with actually at least one manufacturer in terms of coming to an agreement. It is in their legal department corporately. We've been working with them for quite some time, and we expect that that we will have a rebate agreement in the near future. I don't want to specify a date, but we do believe that we will have one for the discount card in the very near future.
Does the leverage that the groups give you help you move any rebate possibility for the individual?
It does. Even though these might be handled in different entities within the same manufacturer, it does provide some leverage. And even though formularies may be different, again, it does provide leverage based on the overall purchasing pool. It does merit attention, and it does have their interest, and they're looking at it from the same reason I think that everyone has looked at it from an implementation or even from a vote perspective, that they do believe it is the right thing to do, and they want to be involved in this to help help with the broader good.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, thank you very much. Thank you for coming down.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. I close the informational meeting on the Oregon on the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, and we'll open an informational meeting on a public hearing on Senate Bill 1062A. My wife tells me Madam Administrator and I are like a comic team here.
That's a good thing.
Oh, okay.
I find it really funny.
I'm sure you do. Let's see. How about who we got on here? We have Susan Cain. And anybody you want to bring with you, or fly solo, Susan, whatever.
Do you just want me to
skip? Oh, please, yes. Yes. No, would you describe the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1062A version comes to you from the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. Left the Senate floor with 30 ayes, no noes. The bill eliminates the requirement that drugs that may be prescribed by certain nurse practitioners and clinical nurse specialists be included in a formulary established by the Oregon State Board of Nursing. This declares an emergency and is effective on passage. There is no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact statement is attached to this bill.
And was there any explanation of why the nurses can't prescribe peyote?
No, Mr. Chair, there was not any discussion on why they can't prescribe heroin or peyote or LSD.
Or any of those things. It's on the staff measure summary.
Well, I think we should go with it.
No, it was just an example, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
She switched parties.
Is that on the record? Has someone been the recipient of some recent prescription?
Someone probably has.
See, now, inquiring mind wants to know.
In fact, I've never been prescribed any of those things. No, use them without prescription. Chris King, sorry to be hilarious up here. I know this is an important issue. Oh, I mean, we're being hilarious. I mean, attempting to be hilarious.
Chair Brainlick and members of the committee, I'm Susan King, the Executive Director of the Oregon Nurses Association, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 1062, as you see amended before you. I'm testifying on the bill, not on the issue of peyote or any other illegal substance. So
any other class 1 drugs, right?
I'm going to try to confine my comments to just that. I think the committee administrator explained the effect of this bill. Essentially, what this does is remove what we believe to be an unnecessary and pretty bureaucratic process, which essentially replicates the work of the FDA by requiring a second review by the Board of Nursing to decide which drugs will go on a formulary of those drugs which can be provided or prescribed by either nurse practitioners or clinical nurse specialists or both. There are approximately 89 drugs not currently on the formulary. I'll give you an example and then would leave it open to questions about the specifics of the bill. One of the general categories that's in the excluded list is general anesthetics. If that formulary requirement is removed, one shouldn't presume that every nurse practitioner or clinical nurse specialist in the state of Oregon would thus prescribe general anesthetics. General anesthetics have a very specific use. They're used within ambulatory surgery centers or hospitals, and they are used by those who are trained, educated, and qualified to use them. So every drug that's on the current formulary, not those of which are excluded, is not provided or prescribed by every clinical nurse specialist or nurse practitioner with prescriptive authority, just as all physicians don't prescribe every drug that they could. The limits on the drugs which one would prescribe are based on clinical judgment, education, training, the patient's presentation and the specific health needs and requirements of that patient. So the removal of this formulary, in essence, removes some resource utilization that the Board of Nursing can certainly use to attend to other issues. It also allows for nurse practitioners and clinical nurse specialists to more quickly tailor drug therapies to their patients' needs. And the final example that I will give to you, we all know that high blood pressure is a growing problem within the U.S. population. I think all of us also know that we're learning more and more how individuals respond to different drugs and drug therapies. And some of the quickest therapies that are needed are to bring down blood pressures in those who are at risk for stroke, heart attacks, and other cardiovascular disease. As new drugs come on the market, certainly we should, I think, support our primary providers in using those new drugs. And when a new drug in this particular category comes on the market currently, sometimes nurse practitioners and clinical nurse specialists would have to wait 3 or 4 months until the Board of Nursing process can be completed when the FDA has already approved it and, in theory, demonstrated that it's safe. So we're asking for your assistance in removing this blockade, if you will, or this barrier to effective drug therapy as utilized by our advanced practice nurses. And I'll be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I have a question about whether the training that certified nurse practitioners and certified clinical nurse specialists, whether the training they receive is consistent in scope with the changes that are contemplated in this bill.
Chair Greenlink and Representative Bonamici, both clinical nurse specialists and nurse practitioners are required to have master's degrees at a minimum. There is movement within the advanced practice community actually to a doctoral level. In addition, each category of advanced practice nurses is required to have the same clinical pharmacology, pharmacotherapeutics. They must have a minimum of 150 hours of precepted clinical practice just in the application of pharmacotherapy therapeutics in their practice. So both of their requirements are the same. And the nurse practitioners actually have been prescribing drugs since 1979 in the state of Oregon independently.
Thank you.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize if you already addressed this in your testimony. I'm wondering how, historically, how closely the nursing formulary has tracked the FDA-approved list. And is it the case that they're exactly the same today?
Representative Greenlick and Representative Cannon, when the nurse practitioners first secured prescriptive authority in the January 1979 session, the formula was far more limited. I actually was on the group that worked with the Board of Medical Examiners and the Oregon Medical Association to oversee that formulary. And it was limited because this was new. This was new practice. For those of you who are not aware, Oregon is far ahead of the rest of the country with respect to our advanced practice nurses. Over time, in 1987, the oversight was moved exclusively to the Board of Nursing, and the formulary was greatly expanded. It used to be a very narrow list of drugs. It was expanded in the late 80s, early 90s to be essentially what is published in Drugs, Facts, and Comparisons, which is essentially all approved drugs in the United States with the exception of the 89 drugs or categories that are currently on the list. So virtually it is an unlimited formulary with those exceptions.
Follow up. Please. Has there been any time since the late 80s when that expansion took place that the Board of Nursing has seen fit to limit by even a single drug the nursing formulary for any reasons related to nursing training and its difference from other practitioners?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Cannon, yes, those 89 drugs and categories represent the exclusions. However, those exclusions are not necessarily related to training per se. And I'll go back to an example that I think is pretty straightforward, and that is general anesthetics. Any physician, primary care physician in a primary care practice would not use a general anesthetic, even though she or he certainly would have legal access to do so, nor would a nurse practitioner in primary care, simply because the venue of their practice, the education that they have to use those specific drugs would not be present. The other limitations are not limitations placed by the board. For example, nurse practitioners and clinical nurse specialists will not be able to recommend medicinal marijuana. That law is limiting. Nurse practitioners and clinical nurse specialists are not participating in the assisted suicide provisions. Those are excluded elsewhere in law.
Can I just try to clarify my question?
You can just keep going.
Okay. So within the schedules, the drug schedules that nurses have, have been on the nursing list, has the Board of Nursing ever seen occasion to, understanding there have been exclusions all along, has there ever been a point where the Board of Nursing has realized that there's some drug that fits a schedule that the nurses are ordinarily allowed to prescribe, but says, you know what, this is not one that we, it's one we should remove from our own list?
Chair Greenlich, Representative Cannon, that has not happened in my memory.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Yes.
Go for it.
You had mentioned, Mr. Chair and Susan, that, and I'm trying to catch what you said, because I read the bill, and the bill talks about nurse practitioners, but I think you said something about advanced nurse practice nursing is at a master's level, and there's a movement toward requiring a doctorate degree. What was that about?
Chair Greenlich and Representative Richardson, all advanced practice nurses in the state of Oregon must have a master's degree. That's a requirement.
In nursing?
Yes, in the preparation for advanced practice in nursing, yes. And there is evolution, if you will, probably towards a doctorate degree in the very near future for some advanced practice nurses. Yes.
Okay. Now, the bill refers to nurse practitioners, and so I'm not clear: is every nurse practitioner an advanced nurse practicing nurse?
Chair Greenlich and Representative Richardson, I apologize. I'm slipping into nursing jargon. Hmm. Advanced practice nursing is a general category that is used as sort of an umbrella to include nurse practitioners, clinical nurse specialists, and nurse anesthetists. Those are the three categories of advanced practice nurses currently regulated in Oregon law.
And so are you really saying, then, just as kind of an aside from other things, that nurse practitioners as a group are going to become more restricted in the future, requiring a doctorate at a time when actually access to health care, we're trying to expand that. So I'm just trying to understand if this silo is getting more restricted as time goes on.
Chair Greenlich, Representative Richardson, I think that what you would hear from the educational programs is that they're trying to recognize that all graduate programs, whether they're in nursing, pharmacy, or others, suffer from degree creep, if you will, or course creep, as the educators call it, and that is the recognition that the knowledge base required for that practice is growing more rapidly than the educational programs can absorb it, and so they add more and more coursework and requirements and end up with a student essentially earning a PhD or a doctor of nursing practice or whatever graduate degree with only the master's degree as the award. So I think we're finding, and I found, my education is as a nurse practitioner, I found that although 45 hours are required generally for master's degrees, mine would have been 60 hours and climbing.
Who makes that determination?
Chair Greenlich and Representative Richardson, it's a variety of factors in terms of who makes it. One, what is the knowledge base that you need in order to practice in the category of provider that you intend to be? Sometimes it's the educational institution that is requiring additional coursework. But I think in healthcare, those of us who are in clinical practice recognize the enormous knowledge base that we're expected to carry for this practice.
The concern is that we as a body are trying to assure that there's greater access to health care. And what I'm hearing you say is that they, or it, and I don't know who that refers to, because my question was who makes that determination, and that there is a greater need for greater knowledge and therefore greater education and therefore greater requirements to be able to continue to do what is currently being done. And so what I'm hearing you say is that somebody is, or some group is making the determination that nurse practitioners really need more training, and therefore there will be greater requirements to qualify in the future because of degree creep or whatever the term might be. And who makes that determination that the current levels of instruction are not sufficient and that we really need to go to more requirements, which, by the way, is not widely available? And so now we have a greater bottleneck for future nurse practitioners because of additional requirements, which will make it harder to become a nurse practitioner, which will mean fewer future nurse practitioners will be available to meet the increasing need for access.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Richardson, I think you're asking the questions that many of us are asking, and I didn't come before you today to necessarily be a proponent of graduate expansion for advanced practice nurses. I don't know that it will ever be a requirement. Certainly there is a movement for that to occur, but at this point the Oregon law, which we support, requires a master's degree. But I would just comment that I think this is common, and it's an issue that probably a number of disciplines will have to confront. Pharmacists are now requiring doctoral preparation in order to be a pharmacist, physical therapist, and so I think all, you know, all disciplines are expanding, and whether or not that should be occurring or not, I think is a bigger discussion that we'd be happy to engage in. But I'm certainly not here representing the educational programs today to be able to fully answer that question for you.
Mr. Vice Chair, this may be analogous to switching the degree from an LLB to a JD in law. You are now a doctor. You have now doctoral
or
training.
Or DO to MD? I mean,
no.
The same.
Well,
no, the same
DO
abilities.
MD, but
I know, but they got expanded in what they could do and essentially got homogenized, although you have different information.
Yeah, I think what I heard Ms. King say is the possibility is the training might not expand much, but the degree that's awarded might change some.
Well, I heard her say from 45 hours to 60-some hours.
So that's what already is.
To be a master's? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just bring it up because sometimes, you know, this process is about becoming educated, and I'm not sure who, when you say, you know, you went to passive voice when you said, you know, the movement is and all that, and I'm asking who is that movement? Who helps this transaction, transaction take place?
That's a discussion for another day, but it might be a good one to put on our interim agenda.
to see where
this is going. Yeah, I mean, not in the context of this bill, but
yeah, that's true.
We are worried about the health personnel issue. Is that Amara? You're probably the one with the closest experience with a nurse practitioner in this group.
Well,
it's your question.
I are married to one.
Ah, yes.
And I'm not with her today. And it's Valentine's Day.
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah, it is very sad. Although, this morning she was kind of chipper. I'm not sure why.
No comment.
It's always telemedicine.
It is. But I do have a conflict with this bill, and I'll state that on the floor. But anyway, I am very supportive of this concept and have been from the first time it was mentioned to me some time ago. And degree professionalism creep is a huge issue. We have now doctors of physical therapy. That doesn't mean that they're better physical therapists from the day one. It just means that the requirement or their education level is higher. It's more about practice and experience that makes good doctors, that makes good nurses, and makes good physical therapists and pharmacists. It's not always about the education within the walls of academia, and I don't want to go into that, but that was a very interesting catch, Representative. I think we need to be cautious about that conversation,
in Oregon. We want to maintain our kind of unique status as kind of way forward compared to other states. When it came up, the first question that anybody should ask himself, does this place the public at greater risk? And I think, and I did a little research, and the answer is clearly no. At the end of the day, if a nurse practitioner does anything outside their scope of practice, then they are liable to, they are held accountable for the practice that they give to their patients, whether it's an inappropriate diagnosis or a prescription they write. They are going to be held accountable by our scope of practice law, which is not changing at all. And so that clearly the answer is no. Would you agree with that? That the public is not put at harm by the passage of this bill?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Maurer, that certainly is our opinion and 30 years of experience with the track record of our nurse practitioners, certainly.
The next question I ask, does this improve access to care? And it's not a major issue, but it certainly wasn't no. It doesn't harm the access to care. And then the third question is, does this reduce or increase the bureaucracy? And you answered that, and you said, well, it reduces the bureaucracy. The one question I don't have answered, and you may not be able to answer this, but how much money are we going to save? And where does that money go?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Maurer, I can't sit here today and give you a specific dollar figure, but I can give you a couple of thoughts on that question. First of all, we do know that it takes some resources of the Board of Nursing, which I pay for, your wife pays for, in order to manage this duplicative process. So to the extent that we can remove it with no harm to the public and, in fact, public benefit, we're going to save the percentage of that staff person's time and the secretarial time to manage that. Additionally, there are a number of volunteer nurse practitioners and clinical specialists who advise that staff person, and their time is volunteer, but it's not free. And so we do have a significant imposition on both the resources of the Board of Nursing and on volunteer time that will not be needed. Secondarily, in some cases, although I wouldn't say to you that I think the majority of cases, where a drug is not on a formulary and a nurse practitioner feels that it is crucial for a patient to receive that drug today because of, you know, whatever the clinical condition, if that nurse practitioner or clinical specialist cannot prescribe it and believes that waiting until it appears on their formulary is not an option, then that person has to seek a physician because that would be the only other person who would be likely to be able to prescribe. And that physician visit, unless they do it on a voluntary basis, which sometimes happens, carries with it a fee. So there's a delay in care in some cases. There is an additional fee for a provider who's licensed and has authority to prescribe that particular drug. And then with respect to the resources of the Board of Nursing, we will be able to save those. And they are approximately, as I understand it, about 7% of the FTE position for the Board of Nursing staff person that is responsible. And I can certainly find out what that dollar cost is if you'd like to know.
No, I'm sure Ways and Means will figure it out next time. Last question. How does this relate, and I don't know the answer to this, how does removing this provision put us in relative terms to other states?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Maurer, Oregon remains the most advanced state for advanced practice nurses, nurse practitioners, and clinical specialists in the country. As we were way out in front in 1979 when this legislature first approved prescriptive authority, which was the big, the centerpiece of that practice. And so this would make us at the forefront of other states, although many other states have modeled their practice acts after ours. But we still would remain the most progressive in the country.
And just as a last comment. Just because you're progressive doesn't mean it's better. But I think that at the end of the day, when you look at how healthcare dollars are allocated, and the easiest numbers to really compare are Medicare numbers. And Oregon, the mortality rate in Oregon overall population is consistent with other states that surround us. Our Medicare dollar expenditures are lower, dramatically lower, and compared to some states, especially California. And I would attribute that to some of the laws that have been passed in the last 20 years, 25 years, and the ability for nurses to practice in new and different ways. And I just hope we continue that, always keeping in mind public safety clearly is number one.
I have a couple of questions. Well, first, a comment triggered by what you just said. I'm impressed with the malpractice rates for nurse practitioners, which is compared to the astronomical numbers we see in medicine, virtually free.
Can I?
Yeah, what?
As a full-time family nurse practitioner, which many nurse practitioners are. Carried by one company, CNA, through the Nursing Services Organization. This year, her policy will be less than $2,000, and clearly is not a hindrance to someone practicing in this state.
First, there's a technical question. I'm not sure you're the right one to answer it, but Vice Chair Richardson and I have been looking at the redefinition of drug on page 2, line 60, line 17 through, lines 15 through 25. Do you know, or do we need to ask the LC, is that a substantive change, or is that simply LC conforming to how drugs are defined in other statutes?
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, I'm not sure if I have the same page 2 as you. Could you tell me which section?
I have the engrossed bill.
Okay. I'm dealing with the facts.
Well, it's a bill it's a set of things that talk about what a drug is. It deletes the statement drug means medicines and preparations of internal and external use human beings, which are recognized in the formulary, adopt and pursue it. It's defined by the formula, and then it substitutes a definition of drugs, which might just be a standard definition of drugs.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my understanding is, as the bill was being drafted, this is used as a standard definition that is trying to encompass all of those formulations that would be used under the general word drug. So it would be the pharmacopoeia.
Right. Could you see if we can get a consultation?
If I recall the discussion, this was clarification. It was LC's recommendation because it matches up with the Board of Pharmacy's definition of drug.
That's what.
But we can. But we can certainly call.
Let's verify that. We'll find something else. That'd be useful. Let me ask you another question. We've passed. I guess in the last session or the session before, statutes that added clinical nurse specialists to the advanced practice nurses. And the discussion we had, and I was a thorn in the side of moving that forward, and eventually we moved it. The argument was that clinical nurse specialists are different than, say, primary care nurse practitioners, and that they practice in a limited practice area. We heard about oncology, cardiology, a variety of things. And it seemed logical for them to be a formulary that related to the specialties that they worked in, psychiatry, another area. Will the force of this be to give them the ability to prescribe drugs beyond what's their area of specialty is, and if so, why would we want to do that?
Chair Greenlich, the shortest answer that I can give you is no. And the reason that I would say that is that although the list of drugs from which any provider can prescribe, whether one is a nurse practitioner, a clinical specialist, or a physician, is currently huge. But not every provider of whatever training is knowledgeable or qualified to prescribe those drugs. So we have no expectation, nor do the clinical specialists across the state, that removing the limitation, some of which are drugs that they wouldn't prescribe anyway, would suddenly give them access to drugs for which they are not qualified to prescribe. So they still would be bound by other parts of the statute which require that any nurse, an RN, an NP, a clinical nurse specialist, has to be practicing according to what they are both educated and trained to do. So this would not expand the list beyond that limitation that already exists and is unchanged by this law.
Is there any other questions? Ms. Kane? Yes. Lieutenant Cannon?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually going to write this in a note to you. It's maybe another technical question. It's related to Section 3, Sub 1, where my reading of this power granted to the board, granted to nurse practitioners for the prescription writing, would looks to me like exceptionally broad when it says including prescriptions for controlled substances listed in Schedules 2, 3, 3, and 4, and 5. It doesn't, there isn't actually a limiting clause on that. So there's something I need help understanding with, and it may be related to another section of statute, but where is the narrowing clause, if any, on a nurse's prescription writing power?
Representative Greenlich and Representative Cannon, the statute that I was referring to exists and in rule, the limitations on practice, and I hope I'm getting at your question, but let me know if I'm going down the wrong road. The limitation on any nurse's practice, mine, a nurse practitioner's, a clinical specialist, is limited by what we are educated and trained to do. I'm an emergency nurse by clinical practice. I don't practice in epidemiology. Therefore, many aspects of clinical practice that another nurse could do, I can't do. And that is an expectation for anyone holding an RN license in this state. So that is the first limitation. If you're a psych mental health clinical specialist or nurse practitioner, you're not probably going to be managing blood pressure because that's not within your education and training. So that's the first limit. The other limit that has been in place and that we are asking to have removed is this redundant and pretty open list that is called the formulary. We have had authority to prescribe Schedule 2 through 5 drugs for a number of years. So all we're doing here is just repeating the scheduled drugs which clinical nurse specialists and nurse practitioners are already authorized to prescribe.
Thank you. I think that helps, particularly the reference to the scope of practice, which isn't in front of us.
Right.
The staff measure summary does say that this would exclude Schedule 1. That's not my reading of Section 3, Sub 1. It may be the intent. Maybe it's other people's reading of that. But to me, it could mean including but not limited to prescriptions for controlled substances. I have a sort of implied but not limited to when I read an including clause like that, including but not excluding.
Chair Greenlich and Representative Cannon, the reason that you don't see Schedule 1 is Schedule 1s are drugs for which there is no medicinal purpose. For example, marijuana is a Schedule 1. Heroin.
There are clearly medicinal purposes for heroin and for marijuana.
Right, but
it's that we don't recognize them in the federal.
Yes. An approved medicinal purpose. So that's where you find heroin. You find morphine in Schedule 2. You find heroin in Schedule 1. You find marijuana in Schedule 1. And that's why you don't see it here, because they are not they're not legally allowed to be prescribed by any provider, physician or nurse practitioner or clinical nurse specialist.
Okay. Thank you.
And we heard from the LC. Do you want to repeat that, Administrator?
Oh.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I talked to Charlie Cheek in Legislative Council, and yes, the lines, page 2, lines 17 through 25, is duplicative language from the Board of Pharmacy statute referencing the definition of drug, which can be found in ORS 689.005, beginning in subsection 10. And Representative Richardson did point out in looking at the statute references animals. The word animals was deleted from this because nurse practitioners probably will not be writing prescriptions for animals.
Sure. Often when we're going through bills that have been drafted for one purpose, there will be items that are included that become law that have unintended consequences. And so my concern is that we've changed the word drug, which previously meant medicines and preparations for internal external use of human beings, which are recognized in the formulary, and instead of just saying period after human beings, and now includes subparagraph A, which is line 17 through 19 on page 2, which I can certainly understand that a drug is an article recognized as a drug by, you know, official, official publications, and we've included to it now that a drug is an article intended for use for prevention of disease in human beings. I'm not sure what that means, because now it includes so many things beyond what merely is normally determined as a drug in the official, the official publications.
Mr. Vice Chair, let Ms. King go. Stand at ease for a moment until we can get Mr. Cheeks on the phone, which we can, and we can talk it over with him, which is probably... Yeah, unless there are other further questions.
No, I would like to ask one more clarification question. Just
about to, this or about
yes,
no?
Yes, about this. Just to make sure that I'm understanding it correctly.
Well,
let's
ask Mr. Cheeks those questions.
Well, I was going to ask Ms. King the question.
That's right.
Before you let her go. I just want clarification to make sure I'm understanding this correctly, that this change is to only to do away with the secondary review procedure, but it is not permitting prescription privileges beyond what is currently done. Is that correct or not?
No.
Chair Greenlich and Representative Bonamici, I would say it slightly differently. I would say that it is in fact changing prescriptive authority to, one, remove the secondary review, and two, remove the requirement that there is a list which a nurse practitioner or clinical nurse specialist must consult each and every time he or she prescribes a drug that is new. So in the case, as I said, of blood pressure medications, yes, it would change the current prescriptive authority environment in that if I were the nurse practitioner, I would not need to consult any longer a list of drugs published in Facts and Comparisons to find out if that new blood pressure medication was on the list. So it does change practice. In our view, it removes a barrier, but it would remove the requirement to consult a list and any limitation that list carries with it.
Yeah, if you look at page 4, line 26, it essentially eliminated the formulary that used to control the drugs that nurse practitioners could. So it opens it up to any legal drug now, any legally prescribed drug.
But my question is, could any legal drug have been included in the formulary once it went through the secondary review procedure?
Some were and some weren't.
Right.
Anyone could have, yes.
Okay, thank you.
But they weren't.
Understood.
It gives more authority to...
Thank you very much. See if you can get Mr. Cheeks, please.
Positive medicine.
Yeah, we're just standing at ease for a moment while we dial the telephone.
I think we do that, don't we?
Yeah, let's stand at ease. Is everybody here? Yes. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1062A. And open a work session on Senate Bill 1062A. And Mr. Cheeks, we have a few questions. And
I've been listening.
Oh, okay. So why don't you answer them?
to Representative Richardson's question, this definition was selected as Sammy told you, from the pharmacy statute. And the addition of articles and other things, I think in the conversation related to, like, prescriptions necessary for syringes for diabetics, other types of devices necessary to render, to deliver drugs to a patient, which was not really in the prior definition.
You've stunned us into silence here.
Can I have
one?
Yes. Yeah. Well, so am I. And so is Representative Zuin. So we understand that. But what we have here is a bill that is relating to what nurse practitioners can and can't prescribe, and we've now expanded this definition of drugs to include syringes. Is that what you were saying? I mean, I understand pharmacies and pharmacists, but what would be the intention of expanding that definition for the purposes included in this Senate bill?
Well, if you were treated with a nurse practitioner and you didn't have an attending physician and you were diabetic and she was prescribing the insulin for you, she would also have to prescribe the syringes.
Can she do that now?
Charlie, could I ask you to turn down the volume on your computer where you're listening to this?
Are you getting feedback?
Yeah, we're getting feedback.
We hear the
That's
echo.
That's confusing me a little bit.
I was hearing it too. Okay.
Go ahead, Representative Richards.
I'm still focusing back on the definition of a drug.
Mm-hmm.
She may or may not say you really need to have syringes. Are syringes a prescription-only device?
Yes. That's my understanding. You cannot go out and buy a syringe without a prescription.
No, that's not true. When I have an injectable medicine I use sometimes, and they'll sell me a package of syringes. But there are devices that do require a prescription.
Isn't the syringe, though, part of your prescription?
It may or may not, but the focus really on this, Charlie, is not just those items that might be intended, which makes sense,
sure,
but the definition of articles intended for the use of prevention of disease, for instance. You skip over the other things that are not included in the national formulary or homeopathic pharmacopoeia or drug compendiums. Now we're going beyond that. I mean, I understand the initial ones, but it says articles other than food that are intended to affect the structure of any function of the body. I mean, this is really broad. So my concern is why we are making this expansion. I mean, I understand that as a drafter of bills, you would like to have consistency. But this is,
Chuck, I don't know whether you can answer this.
Consequences.
I don't know whether you can answer this question, but do you know whether these articles were included in the formularies before? And maybe.
I don't know that, no.
Anybody back here answer that question?
Mr. Chair, I actually have the OAR.
Okay. Are devices included in that? Articles? It's not devices, but it's articles.
It says appliance or device.
Yeah. And that's included in the current formulary?
In the formulary that exists today, yes. In there, it's OAR 851-056-0012. Which means an instrument, apparatus, implement, machine, contrivance, implant, in vitro reagent. If I may just comment, a prescription isn't necessarily for an item such in C, where it says articles other than food intended for, aren't items that are dangerous. But the insurance company won't pay for it unless your provider gives you, quote, a prescription for such as a walker or such as, an in-home, a bed.
A hospital bed.
Hospital bed. They require a prescription so that the insurance company will identify that as a medically necessary item.
Let me focus right in on what I'm trying to avoid. I'm trying to. There are federal rules involving the FDA that prevents the FDA from taking certain steps that would regulate food supplements, and those kinds of things, vitamins and so forth, as you know, as regulated items like prescriptions. Okay, they can't do that. I want to make sure that we don't, by unintended consequences of wording that we put into whether it's an existing thing for pharmacies or what's being contemplated in this bill, include as a drug those things which are articles used to for the prevention of disease or for treatment and other things. I don't want to expand the definition of drug under the state of Oregon to include unintentionally or intentionally by some people, but you know, not necessarily, just any items that are not currently considered as drugs.
Your once a day.
Charlie, did you have a comment on this one?
Well, I thought I had a little difficulty hearing Representative Maurer, but I think the point was well taken that it's not just the drug itself; it's other health-related items. I also understand what Representative Richardson is saying, and I think my understanding would be that as this currently reads, this definition of drug, a pharmacist could not dispense those vitamins as per a prescription because they're not included as a drug. They're considered food supplements or whatever else we call those, or nutritional supplements, I think is what they're called. So they're not under the definition of drug. But I see the representative's point, but I just, given that this is a definition that's been used for pharmacists for several years,
as
drug, the definition of drug, it seemed to me that we were providing consistency there by using that one.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, that was going to be my comment. We have to have a definition of drug because the previous statute referred us to the formulary, and since we don't have that anymore, I'm comfortable with the consistency with the Board of Pharmacy. So, and maybe if there's a question about that definition, that's maybe another conversation. But if that's what we have already...
Well, the goal comes, do we support this bill or do we fight this bill because of unintended consequences because the period on line 20, or semicolon on line 19 wasn't sufficient, which would resolve the problem as far as formularies.
Well, I expect it would have left ambiguity. I mean, if we had just said drugs, then they'd have had to go to the statute somewhere else to find the definition, and this is where they would have found it.
Right, and what I'm saying is that this part certainly deals with the issue. It's the intention of the other things beyond.
I wonder if
aren't they in the drug? I mean, did we hear that A through D is in the definition of drug
For pharmacists?
Yeah. Charlie, has there been a problem with this definition for the pharmacist?
As far as I know, there has not, Representative Costa. The only change that I made was deleting the words or animals. Or other animals from line 21. And I think that was because the definition for a pharmacist, when the veterinarian needs to get drugs, they get them from a pharmacist. And some of those drugs, of course, are intended for these, obviously for animals and not human beings.
How long has the pharmacy had the definition that's included presently in 689.005?
Well, I've been doing it 10 years, and I don't recall changing it, but I certainly can't say that for certain that it's been for that whole 10 years.
Okay. That's not new.
No, not to my recollection.
I just wanted to bring it up. I'm looking in the statutes, and it looks like 1983, 1979, 1983, so it's been in a long time. Okay, I'm okay.
Representative Bonamici?
Representative Kotek asked the same question I was going to ask. So.
Okay. Representative Flores?
Thank you. And it's certainly not a question because I have broad knowledge in this particular area, but it's just interesting to me that the definition of drug includes appliances and medical devices. So that's interesting.
Yeah, medical devices is a broad range. It includes things like artificial hips and lenses in the eye and a variety of things. That
not the normal, ordinary person's understanding of what would be normally considered a drug, usually something that you consume, ingest, and...
Yeah, yes, indeed. Are there any other... I mean, the FDA has the authority for both drugs and devices, and they really... I think they're just smushed together in this definition.
This isn't about drugs specifically. This is about prescription authority.
Although we're talking about a definition of drugs in this particular scenario, and I don't have an objection. I just find it a matter of interest.
Are we done with Mr. Cheeks?
Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can I have a motion on this bill, please?
Mr. Cheeks?
Yes.
I would move that Senate Bill 1062A be referred to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
We have a motion on the floor. Discussion of that motion.
I just have a comment, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. Catching a cold. I'm going to support the bill. I just think it's interesting that when we had a bill in the 07 session to expand prescription privileges for psychologists, there was a massive amount of opposition. And I understand the difference here, that these people under this bill are already trained to prescribe. But I just think it's interesting that there isn't that. So we're expanding prescription privileges under this bill, and nobody's opposing it, which I think is interesting. But I plan to support it. I do.
You're disappointed?
No, I'm not disappointed. I'm not disappointed at all. Obviously, there are distinctions. Rather than starting at an entirely new class of people who will have prescription privileges, but it's just an interesting concept that this is here with absolutely no one opposing it, and it's an expansion. So I think that probably speaks highly of the concept.
Yes, Mr. Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've had a very interesting discussion today, and I wanted to bring it back to what I understood the intent of the bill to be, which was to ease the ability for nurse practitioners to be able to deliver care to the patients that they serve. And I think we had a little bit of a discussion about the importance of these particular practitioners to providing access to people across the state of Oregon, to providing affordable and high-quality health care. So I'm very happy to support a bill that is going to enhance their ability to provide care to our constituents. I have every confidence that they will do that safely, as they have, and that this will just remove impediment and delay in delivering the appropriate care to the patients that they work on behalf of.
Okay. Any other discussion? Those in favor of this motion will vote aye when their name is called. We have a roll call.
Aye.
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 President
Ford.
Aye.
President Gelser.
Aye.
President Maurer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cooper.
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Greenwood.
Aye. Motion passes.
Do
we have a carrier?
Okay.
You carry? Vice Chair Richardson will be the carrier. You want to help him?
It's the conflict.
Yeah, okay. We'll do it on. Vice Chair Richardson will be the carrier. He did know his conflict. What, you want to note it again?
Yes, Mr. Chair. My wife is a nurse practitioner.
We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1062A. And we have a little more business.
No.
Take that. No meeting tomorrow. I intend to put out a couple of questions for the public to respond to toward the end of, in a session toward the end of next week. They're the continuation of our work session, of our interim work on health licensing boards, and I thought maybe the best way to stimulate conversation would be to propose a couple of things that might actually get some interest on the part of people in the reaction. And those two questions I would like to put out, and I'll put one on each day and ask for witnesses to volunteer, is one, should every healthcare licensing board have a majority of public members? And that's not necessarily the answer I think we will want to put into an omnibus bill, but the fact is several of us have noted the current balance between public and professional members seems inadequate, and what the ultimate answer we come to on how this should be changed, it would seem to me, would be stimulated by
I would say, the strongest potential null hypothesis, although I suppose you could have a null hypothesis that to test that would say only public members were a part of health licensing boards. I don't think that makes any sense, but we'll ask that and we'll see what comments we get. The second question I'd like to put out for public discussion is a question that came about because we got testimony that there's no oversight on these health licensing boards, that they're there and they seem to be autonomous or semi-autonomous, we're not sure, but there's no oversight. And the second question would be, should there be a place in the administrative arm of government that has oversight over the activities of the health licensing boards in Oregon? And I put in the administrative arm because it seems that's probably the most likely place. We've heard about the governor's office. We've heard about the Department of Public Health, or the Public Health Division. There's a variety of things. And we might also end up, we have some ultimate oversight. But it's not clear what oversight we have except to change statutes. So, but at any rate, I wanted a specific way for us to have a discussion of the oversight question. We're going to have we've asked the governor staff to talk to us next, probably Tuesday or Wednesday, about this whole question of how board members are named and the extent to which board members can be removed by the governor. We found we have different statutes for every board, including some boards that don't have anything. Some statutes say board members can be replaced only for cause. Some say they can be replaced at will by the governor. They serve at the will of the governor. And some statutes that are silent on this issue. And we thought we'd see what the governor thinks about how this could go as a part of furthering that discussion. So this is a part of moving forward our interim agenda on what I hope we will end up creating a omnibus health licensing board reform bill before we come into the 2009 session. Ms. Kotek, you have?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I look forward to the conversation. I was wondering if we would have the availability of your wonderful staff person, Tom, to come and do two things. One, I can't recall, did he do some research around board membership and regulatory boards in other states?
No.
And that might be challenging, but an overview before we have the conversation about public membership to have a review of some of that. I don't think he needs to do a lot, but that might be a good starting point. And then
we could ask NCSL whether they have some information.
That would be great, we might have a couple days to do that.
And see whether we could maybe get some testimony by phone at any of these hearings.
Or any some documents that might have a chance. Right.
That would be helpful.
Yeah.
And Sandy,
and
can I?
Oh, may I finish? I'm sorry, just quickly. And then on oversight mechanisms, and I think this leads to what you were inviting the governor's staff, is an oversight mechanism, the appointment process, the removal process. I'm just, getting a sense of what that is. And do you also want to throw out maybe another question, and probably don't have the time, but are there suggestions for merging any of the boards?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I have a kind of a correlating question to that, mm-hmm. which would be, is there a reason why there couldn't be consolidated renewal of licenses when they are just a renewal?
Yeah. Central way to renew a license.
Right. So why does each board need to be doing renewals when it's just a perfunctory thing?
Let's make that question, which really relates to a third observation I had, the question of how could we combine functions among the boards. The boards had it in their mind that I was determined to merge all health policy licensing boards. I keep telling them it is not my intention at all, at least my intention, and I hadn't heard anybody else on the committee, although apparently this was a very lively discussion in, I think, the 1997 or 1999 session, before I guess any of us were here. But there, it is clear that some functions ought to be moved, and one that I think we ought clearly be asking about is this question of the impaired professional. But I think Representative Kotek has broadened that question a bit, and as Representative Richardson to ask not only is there the possibility of merging some boards, but the other question is there a possibility of combining functions of boards? Some boards act with very small staff. I mean, some boards have like a half-time executive and a half-time secretary, and that's their whole staff. And you think it might be a little hard for them to deal with what they want. So, yeah, Sandy, let's see if we can formulate a question. And we can, if we start with these, we'll have more to go as to what kind of functions could we be integrating, which does get to a variety of these things. Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a while back run across an article from some periodical about the public-private membership on licensing boards. And Sandy, I know, distributed that via email at one point, and if anybody needs it again, maybe Sandy still has it.
Okay. Let's do it again. Yeah. It's in my file, but I haven't looked at them. That'd be great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would add to the list of questions whether there are any emerging fields of practice that may need new boards or need to be covered through other existing boards.
Oh, let me report to you the on this question, and that is important. On the Oregon Board of Radiology Tech, they have really been responding wonderfully to what we told them after the last session. If you want to convert yourself into a board of diagnostic imaging and bringing sonography and a variety of other things, you really need to think about how you can reformulate your board, including reformulate the membership, and make sure that you've talked to these other occupations. They've done what I think has been a very impressive job, having a set of public meetings, trying very hard to get everybody in. They seem to be moving in a logical way. The OMA has expressed some interest in this, and I've suggested that they talk to them about perhaps them proposing a statute about how that board can be worked. But this is an example of one of those areas where technology has outstripped our existing regulatory agencies, but particularly their executive director, I think, has done an extraordinary job of trying to hear what we said and to try and move forward. And I've been attending most of their public meetings to encourage them to keep doing this. And I think they're getting close to something we can rationally consider.
And then the second half of my comment was that you had indicated you were going to send a questionnaire out and you were hoping to stimulate some input from the public. And now that I've been here for a while, I have learned that when you send something out to generate more feedback, if you include the word fluoride, it will increase the
That's right.
Fluoride or stem cells is another one.
Fluoride and stem cells. And any new omnibus board could be co-chaired by the physical therapist and the chiropractor.
Yeah, well, I suppose that would be a good example, to see whether we could merge the chiropractic and the physical therapy board. That would save us a lot of scope of practice problems.
Taking that one step further, how about fluoride as a fundamental right?
There you go.
Corvallis does have fluoridated water, and we did learn about Corvallis this morning.
And I do believe it's a fundamental right.
I really think God told us that fluoride is a fundamental right.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
On a little bit of a different topic, and conversely to that point, I wonder if there's been any indication about if the reflexologists are operating properly now that we've freed them from the requirement to be licensed at all.
I think we should ask the governor to report to us on that one. Maybe he has some oversight on that. Incidentally, we have taken your list seriously.
Sure didn't help you get.
Sandy, do you want to talk about the hearings that we are scheduling for next week in response to the list?
I'm not sure what your question was.
Well, we were talking about doing the child abuse one.
Right.
Right?
Right. There will be some other topics. We'll be hearing from OHSU as soon as I can get a hold of them on overview on the clinical drug trials from and a situation that they're facing, and then in response to Representative Gelser and the child abuse assessment, rural communities, as soon as I can get your gentleman's number. So I believe what the chair is driving at is most of our meetings next week, in fact, I think I can safely say all of our meetings next week will be informationals. So we'll be looking for topics.
And expanding care questions.
And assist with me in making sure that we get all you guys' issues as well as some interim issues covered in our meetings next week.
It's not clear how
when the session will end, but except for Friday.
It's clear, Mr. Chair.
No, it's not, because there are some rumors that will end sooner than we expected. So I'm not sure we'll have 2 weeks of hearings. So we're scheduling next week. And if it looks like the session will end at the end of next week or very early the week before, we may meet Friday of next week as well to do some of this work. But if it looks like it'll go into the last week, then we'll do four meetings next week, and then as many meetings as there's time to do in the last week.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So any of the health-related bills that have passed the Senate, the only one that we're going to see that has not gone to Ways and Means is the one we've seen today?
That's what I checked today, and that's what it looks like. There are another three or so tied up in Ways and Means.
Well, and I've heard some concerns about one in particular, and if we had, you know, the challenge with them going to Ways and Means is we won't get to see them unless we make a particular request. And would you, if we have concerns about bills not having some additional review, should we?
Well, our
particularly the telemedicine bill.
Our deadline for our dealing with the Senate bill is next Tuesday.
Okay, so if
so,
we.
So
it would
have
to be referred to rules or somewhere else if it needed more policy work. If
you
wasn't
going to craft an amendment, testify before Ways and Means, and talk to the sub-chair about getting it amended in Ways and Means.
If it gets heard in Ways and Means, that's
okay.
The problem.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, thank you.
So I think our job in terms of the session bills is done today.
In terms of, okay, thank you.
Any other? Unless we get special authorization to reopen for a single bill. I mean, that is a possibility, that if there was a bill that the Speaker thought we had something to say about, he has in the rules the ability to reopen our committee for work on a particular bill. But it's going to have to get out of Ways and Means first.
May I have 1 minute to talk about the board's position?
Yeah.
There's another question that I think on the boards, and that is defining what the purpose of the board is. Because, I mean, one of Milton Friedman's books dealing with economics and government brought out a very interesting aspect of what's happened in federal boards and agencies, and that is that agencies will be established like FDA, Department of Transportation, because of specific problems that have developed. And then within 5 to 10 years, those agencies that were developed to solve a problem become controlled by those who developed the problem to begin with. Department of Transportation initially dealt with railroads that had monopolies that were breaking the farmers' backs by raising the price on getting produce in. And so you had people saying, we've got to stop this. And so they set up a federal agency to regulate an area. And then after that was done, they said, great job, let's go do something else. And they left, but the ones who had an interest were the trains, the railroads. And so within 5 to 10 years, the boards were serviced or were comprised of the very members representing the industry, I mean, had connections with the industry that were intended to be regulated. And so FDA and their relationships with the pharmacological industry and all these things, they're very closely related, and they end up, there are some who would say the agencies gain the power to kind of control the outcome, and so they become a way to stop competition by those very groups that were trying to be regulated to begin with. And so we don't have that same problem in state, except it wouldn't hurt to say, you know, what are we trying to accomplish with the boards as we discuss who should be those that are members of the boards? Because I think that, yeah, I'm not real clear on it.
Well, and part of that comes into the public membership.
Which you would. Maybe not, you know, if it's to regulate, then certainly you don't want just the majority of people to be those that should be regulated.
You take me back with this comment to a wonderful dinner I had with Professor Friedman and his wife, Rosa, was her name, at Reed College when I was hosting a lecture series, and he was the lecturer. And he argued very strongly in that, and did, I think, in a book later, that we shouldn't be regulating health professionals.
That's right. He said that it's closed shop, and that's why you have such difficulty.
He said, let the market regulate.
Let the market regulate it. You go to people that you trust.
If I claim I'm a physician and advertise for
brain surgery patients, the market will determine whether I'll get it or not.
He stirred it up
very seriously. Wow, so, I mean, it wouldn't hurt somewhere along the line to ask the basic question I think you're asking is, what is the function of health license? I think we'll probably stick with the notion that we want to do something like that, but we may not be doing it right.
Well, I find that intriguing, and that if we're looking at the purpose of various boards, that might certainly have a downline effect of whether or not there needs to be some coordination, combining, or leave them alone, but it would give maybe a review and analysis that has not been done either ever, I don't know, or certainly for quite some time.
Probably ever. Yeah, what I've been grappling with is how between now and, say, November, when we need to have a bill in place that's been vetted, what the process we can use to get to some of these underlying questions, which I think makes a difference whether we just assume this or whether we ask about why this and not that.
And that comes back to that line of questioning about making it more difficult to become nurse practitioners, which becomes a turf issue and has to do with income and incentives and all those things at a very time when we're trying to say, by loosening things up with nurse practitioners, we can have greater access. And in reality, maybe we're getting less.
And that conversation is informed with a national debate that is attempting to increase the professional perception of nurses in order to compete against the American Medical Association.
Yeah.
And so there are some...
You need to recognize that's going on.
Very definitely. I mean, and quite frankly, I'm totally opposed to that direction because I think it does nothing to increase access.
And you talk about professionals working at the top of their license. Well, we define what their license is. I mean, we haven't gotten working at the top of even what we define, but couldn't we define that top higher?
We could through statute. The board tells, or they control who gets licensed in the state of Oregon. So all they do, if they want to, through a administrative rule, is change the educational level.
And yep.
Education's happening all the time. You do stair steps. Isn't that right, Ben? You know, and you better your summaries, you're going to be spending time getting further along, so, you know, so that because your income is tied into the step levels and
yep.
all those things, not to your ability to teach.
Well,
I mean, that's a different issue.
Mr. Chair, there's one more thing I want to mention, too, before we wrap up, and that's it may be encompassed within your discussion about the impaired professionals, but we had a lot of discussion in the last session about how and if and when a licensee is entitled to a contested case proceeding in the whole administrative law field and how that when that comes up. So somehow or another, we need to address that issue.
We're having this discussion on the record because we're talking about our interim work plan and how to further that interim work plan. So
right.
We're not talking about substantive issues. Yeah, I think you raised an important issue. Another issue that's been raised as a part of the discussion that we may want to look at in this interim is the representation by the deputy attorney generals on the boards, and who is the client of a DAG when they're sitting in front of us representing the nursing board? Is it the nursing board that's the client, or is it the public that's
conflict
the client?
Interest.
And how does that attorney deal? I mean, in a private firm, I don't think an attorney could be representing both. And I think
only if you have consent.
Hmm?
If you have consent, you can.
I don't consent.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's true. That's absolutely true. I know that, for example, in divorces, it's sometimes done. But it is a problem, and it's also a problem in terms of how they're funded, because the other side of the problem I've heard a complaint about is that it's expensive to get the consultation of a deputy attorney general, and some boards, because of the way it's funded, are reluctant to ask for help when they should ask for help.
$120.
Yeah. So, I mean, these are all things I think we have to figure out a way that we have at most say, 8 more meetings of this committee before we adjourn at most, and probably less than that, and then we probably have, I've asked Sandy to see how many she thinks we can get in the interim, but I would guess no more than, I mean, the rest of the interim, I would guess no more than 4 more, including the last one, which would be when we need to approve a bill for pre-session filing. So I think these next 4 to 8 meetings that we have while we're all here together are kind of precious time for us to move this agenda forward. All right? Anything else for the good of the order?